You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Joanna Griffiths, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You are the CEO, founder of NYX. It's a direct-to-consumer, intimate apparel brand. How do you describe it these days?
So yeah, I would describe it as a direct-to-consumer women's intimate apparel brand. And we're really trying to reinvent products for today's modern woman and to redefine what it means to be a brand in today's digital space. So we're kind of the brand that's there for women through every life stage and phase. And that's from a product perspective and a brand content perspective, really tackling the subject matter and the challenges that women face throughout their ever-evolving lives.
And recently, and how long ago was this? You launched a teen line as well called NYX Teen. When was that?
So that was 2017. So it just celebrated its second birthday.
So that's pretty fascinating because that's sort of extending the scope of the type of women that you're trying to help. So that makes it like basically from the start, it's like teens all the way to who are your oldest customers, do you find?
We've had some pretty old customers. Yeah. We hear often stories about women who are buying for themselves, and then they're buying for their moms, and then they buy for their grandmothers. So we're very multi-generational brand. We started in leak-proof underwear, and so we're very long on leak-proof. And part of the thought process there was to create a teen line because it can be pretty challenging to kind of change a consumer's behavior when they've been doing something a certain way for a really long time. And so part of our logic there was to be there for girls from cycle one. But through that product, I mean, we really cater to a large, diverse group of women of all different ages.
I think that's really fascinating because there's I think the direct-to-consumer movement or thing that's happening right now is really probably thought of as being geared towards millennials, but you're addressing a much broader spectrum of the population than that. Is there anything different about how you are advertising or developing products or anything about your approach when it comes to addressing the different cohorts or different generations that you're trying to talk to?
Part of what I identified when I was starting the company back in 2013 was that women weren't really properly represented in marketing. And so for us, you know, that started with being inclusive from a sizing perspective and showcasing women of all different shapes and sizes. And I'd say that that's evolved for us specifically as a brand to be age inclusive as well. And so from what we're seeing is that people want to feel a connection to a brand. Like they want to feel like a brand is making products specifically for them. And part of that is allowing customers to kind of see people that look like them or that they identify with in the marketing. And so that's definitely been something that's been core to NYX really since we started, and we're continuing to do it and continuing, I'd say more recently, to bridge into some older demographics. Like I think that for a really long time, if you were bigger than a size 4, let's say, you were pretty much invisible in marketing. And now, thanks to Instagram, like that's definitely changing, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But there still is this huge void where marketers kind of like to pretend that all women die after the age of 40.
It's pretty crazy.
It is kind of crazy. You even see it in movies, right? Like I think it's getting better. Because you have these like very iconic actresses like Jennifer Aniston and Gwyneth Paltrow and like, you know, these women that are able to sort of continue to play the lead character into their 40s. But there was a long time where you were like the it girl and then you became the mom character, you know. So I'd say at the moment a passion of mine is making sure that we are representing older women in our marketing as well.
Yeah. And it's like when you think about older actresses, it's like, you know, Judi Dench, and there's like three people that come to mind and that's about it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you think about like older male actors, it's just, you know, probably 30 different people come to mind.
And they can still be heartthrobs, you know,
like, for sure.
You know, like people like Sean Connery or like any of the Bond men, I still think that people would think of them as being these like hunks. But then for women, it's like, basically, you know, disappear after a certain age. So I think that's really cool. We're not the only brand that's doing it. And I find it really encouraging to see other brands as well acknowledge that customers exist beyond a certain age range.
And when you browse, I was on your Instagram before we started recording, the images you feature, as you mentioned, are from your customers, but they're also not showing always the more glamorous side of someone. Like, these are obviously intimate apparel, but also like intimate moments. Some things are very personal, women after their pregnancies and that kind of stuff. And I do think it's kind of like more being honest about what real human beings' bodies are in the real world.
Yeah, sometimes it's out there. I mean, I think we've certainly been at the forefront of sort of testing boundaries about what we can post. And you're right, like really honoring the beauty that is women's bodies and the fact that they're different. And I mean, I just had a baby myself 12 weeks ago. So I've kind of like just come through a new stage personally. But your body changes, and it changes for a whole whack of reasons. And we love to showcase that. And then we like to do some wacky stuff too. Like, I'm sure if you just went on our Instagram, you saw this like slow motion challenge that one of our ambassadors has been doing, where basically in slow motion, she jiggles her body. It's really taking off online to kind of even acknowledge the concept that like we have skin and roles and different parts of our body. And guess what? When you move, they move, you know, yeah. And that's like part of being human. So yeah, we love to kind of take a human approach to the way that we tell stories.
This was a life-changing moment for me. And I think I've talked about this in the podcast a while back, but when I started, I think in like my mid-20s, I started going to the sauna and like the baths basically like nearby where I live in steam rooms and stuff. I think the average age of the people who go to the place that I go to is probably like in the 50 to 60s range. So I realized at that moment that I was like, if I have a son, I'm definitely going to take them at an early age to this place, because there's so much shame that happens, like especially as a teenager, around your body, and it extends your whole life. But then when you start walking around and seeing everyone's bodies, you're like, hey, everyone's weird. we're all like this.
Yeah. And also, I think an interesting thing happens where you kind of like, you see it, you acknowledge it, and then you just mentally move on, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a really freeing thing to kind of realize that like, no one is judging you or looking at you the way that you are judging and looking at yourself. And I think that's a lot of like the stories that we try to tell, which links back to our mission of this idea of being unapologetically free. It's just kind of like letting go of all of that baggage and emphasis that we put on certain things that just like, quite frankly, aren't important, you know?
Was there something that from your pregnancy really, I mean, I'm sure there's so much to be learned from that, but was there anything that you brought back to Nick's and the team during that process or afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, so we're launching our maternity collection in, 4 weeks, I guess.
Wow, timely.
Yeah, so very timely. And I think it was probably a very interesting case study, because I basically came back 2 weeks postpartum to give my team the creative briefing and vision for our postpartum collection. There are so many things that happen to your body that no one really talks about. That industry in particular hasn't evolved as much as, say, the intimates category on a more broader basis. You know, certainly around the concept of breastfeeding being an example, like I was astonished at the fact that it's actually really hard. And all of the images that I'd ever seen really for nursing bras or maternity were kind of like really happy looking women, you know, holding like the easy undo clasp, kind of like with this extravagant smile on their faces. And the secret that nobody tells you is that it's actually can be a really challenging thing.
I'm already seeing the marketing for you.
You can see it, right? I know.
It's all going to be photos of people who are very upset.
Oh, our pictures? Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like it's going to be up there. I'll tell you that much. And I think I kind of like shell shocked my team.
Oh, wow.
But, it's cool. Like, I love being able to do that. I love that as a company, we're you know, entering into new components or areas of the space that maybe haven't had the same level of disruption as the mainstream intimates category has had, and being able to spark some new conversations there.
When you say, I want to explore this, when you say you shell-shocked your team, like exactly what happened there?
Well, I was like pretty busy, so I had a lot of stuff going on, obviously. So my briefing was a couple of those photos with like the dumb fake smiles. I'm really bad at making aesthetically pleasing presentations to begin with, and this is probably one of my worst. And then I like crossed them out, and then I think my like insight was breastfeeding is hard AF. Like, then grab some like pretty graphic photos from the internet of like what it's actually like. It's also been remarkable to me because we do these casting calls, and we've been doing a lot of calls for UGC around this. And so we've had like hundreds and hundreds of women share their intimate photos post-birth. And so our creative team at the moment is kind of going through a little bit of shell shock as they go through all of these like very intense and real photos.
Have you found that that's been something with the composition of your team where the people on your team are not experienced with with that? Or is that something like you're trying to bring more perspective in the product development or marketing where you have people who have been through that process themselves?
I think that we have a pretty diverse team, so that's great. And then we're certainly doing things to educate. So last Friday, as an example, we have a woman on our customer service team who's training to be a midwife. And so she led a birthing 101 session for the entire organization and kind of broke everything down so that if you're not aware, we're at least giving you like the tools and the information to get a better sense. But something that we screen for in all of our interviews is a sense of empathy, so that even if maybe it's new to you or you haven't experienced something before, you can very quickly like understand where someone's coming from. I always say, you know, because when you're a challenger brand, there's always going to be a lot of other companies that have way more money than you do, whether they're just legacy brands that have been around for forever, or they're competing startups that have raised, you know, 10 to 15 to 100 times the amount of money that you have. And for us at Nix, I think our empathy and our authenticity are two things that you just can't buy. And we've been doing these shoots with our customers now for 6 years. Like, it's basically been since the inception of the brand. And you see other companies try and mimic it, but it's actually a really hard thing to do and to execute on, because you have to be really comfortable with the fact that the product's not going to look perfect. You have to be comfortable with the fact that you're working with people who maybe aren't that natural in front of the camera, and you have to encourage them and bring them out of their comfort zone. What I found over the years is you kind of just have to roll with it. Like, if you fuss too much about fixing how something fits, then the person gets in their head and then you lose that magic, you know? And so I actually would love to just be a fly on the wall at some other brand shoots and see how they do it, because I know that ours is sort of this like beautiful magic chaos kind of thing that happens, where we're basically the cheerleaders that are championing these women as they oftentimes model for the first time ever and do it in their underwear.
Do you find that they're, how comfortable are they about that?
Yeah. So often it starts, the first hour is usually really, really awkward. You know, people are very shy and they're wearing the robes and they don't really talk to one another, and they kind of like, you know, they're on their phones like we all do when we're in an uncomfortable situation. You try and like make it look like you're busy or doing something. And then by the end of the day, oftentimes they're like best buddies for life.
That's
and
awesome.
Like, no one knows where their robes are. They've, you know what I mean? Like, something happens where they just kind of let go throughout the process of the day. As a female founder, it's actually been huge for me in terms of even my own level of confidence and self-acceptance, is that like every time we do one of those shoots, I just feel my own personal barriers kind of coming down a little bit more and a little bit more as you see these people really undergo these transformations.
But it's also a skill that your team, your photography team, has to develop, which is like how to make people feel comfortable. How did you get to that point?
I think it's just been this evolution, to be honest. And a lot of it has to do with hiring the right people. You know, I'm still really involved in a lot of our photo shoots and try to be on set whenever I can, at least so that the rest of the group gets to see kind of how I interact with people. And then ideally they can, you know, take on a similar approach. But there's no recipe. I think like you just have to really believe in the output, you know, and believe that every person is beautiful and that, like, you know, the greatest gift that someone can have is confidence and belief in themselves. And if you create an environment where that starts to shine through, then you can capture something that's really magical. I think it's a scary thing for a lot of brands to endeavor into.
I'm like going to your website right now, trying to go to your like careers page to see if like, is your whole team photo just like everyone in their underwear?
No. It's not. It's actually not. Although,
why not? It should be.
Yeah, it's true. We've done photos in our tanks before.
It reminds me of, I don't know if you know Sagmeister and Walsh. They're like a famous graphic design company, and they pose completely nude for their team page. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should do that.
You should. I don't know. Well, you should be wearing probably your
Well, obviously wear our products. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll run it by our HR lead and make sure that she doesn't panic too much. I can just imagine tomorrow I go in, I'm like, I have a great idea. Everyone's going to pose in their underwear together. She's going to be like, oh, Joanna.
I don't know.
You never know.
You got to live your own values.
Yeah, exactly.
So one thing that I've noticed, and you sort of have alluded to it kind of in passing, but a lot of your products seem to be geared towards a specific goal that you're trying to help with. You've talked about the period underwear and maternity. And so I'm just wondering, from your product development process, is that where things start oftentimes, as you're trying to solve some sort of utilitarian problem, or is it also coming from other directions as well?
No, it's usually trying to solve for something intentional. We view intimates as anything that's next to skin. So that's sort of like the parameters or the guardrails that we use as like constraints to stay focused. A lot of our initial ideas come from our customers. So people will say now, like, oh, hey, I feel like you might be the brand that actually makes this, or, you know, and we approach a product and really try to understand, like, okay, what are the good things about this product or category? Like, what do people like so that we don't change them? And then what's the like pain point or frustration point where, if we just improve that one thing, we actually could have like a very transformative effect on our customer. I'm sure like a lot of the brands that you have on the show, we use Facebook and Instagram a ton for our marketing. And we were really early to adopt video as sort of the storytelling method. And because our products like serve a very clear function, it's actually made it really quite easy for us to communicate that value prop and to have customers understand like why they should buy from us.
It does feel like this general area has had a decent amount of technological evolution over the past 20 years or so. And you've been, you know, emphasizing that in your marketing, on your website. Do you think there's still a lot of unexplored space there in terms of like what's possible? I think of companies like Nike that, you know, put a lot of weight behind the R&D of those types of things, where, you know, they'll come out with a technology and really try to get a lot out of that for 5 or 10 years or something like that. And when I look at what you're doing, I kind of see some parallels there.
Yeah, I still think that there's a lot of room. I mean, Nike's an interesting one. We launched a high impact sports bra last year that took us a couple of years to develop. And we, you know, the end product we sent for third-party testing to a university in the UK that's kind of like the leaders in breast movement and breast health. Amazingly, like NYX, our high-impact sports bra outperformed all 800 bras that they had previously tested. It outperformed the leading bras from like all of the major brands. And I remember doing an interview, I forget which outlet, like maybe with Fast Company or something. And they're like, how did you do this? Like, how does a company that is, you know, a fraction of the size and doesn't have nearly the same amount of resources, innovate and create something that's superior to these huge brands that have what would seem like endless R&D resources. And I think there's something about the way that we approach product that's just so pure. And because we're so small, the people who are coming up with the concepts and building the product are in constant contact with our customers, which just keeps the process humble or something. Like, I think almost sometimes when you get so big, so many people touch something that it can kind of get ruined or lost in translation in the process. Does that make sense at all, what I'm describing?
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like there's something really beautiful about being small and nimble and really sort of rethinking through things.
Well, I think what it allows you to do is just like care way
more. It allows
more.
Us to care. Totally. Yeah. Totally.
But, yeah. But at the same time, like caring and, you know, the pressure of having to ship something kind of are at odds with each other sometimes. Like, I think you can care more when you're a small group of people because it's just like you have the ability to all get in a room together and just say like, this is really important. We got to do something for that. But then when it comes to a multi-year R&D process, especially since I know that you haven't, as far as I know, raised money at, or maybe you have recently, but haven't been able to do that in the past, like you have to be able to dedicate some resources and decide like, when is a good endpoint? When are we ready to release this? Is this good enough? How do you get to that decision moment?
I'd say they were a lot more cautious about that now than we used to be. But I do agree, like at a certain point, you kind of just have to go with it. And I feel like for me in particular, you can tweak and tweak and tweak, you know what I mean? And kind of like never release something. But for us, it's like doing the wear testing and giving it to like a large number of women and getting the feedback and making sure that we feel really comfortable about what we're getting behind and then not rushing things. I mean, I was the one who's like, I don't want to talk about Kickstarter, but I've learned those lessons the hard way. Like coming up through a platform like that, you sell a bunch of product before it's necessarily like totally complete. And I think in the early days, like I rushed things a little bit and I learned a lot from that. Like I learned that if I wasn't happy with like a back closure or something and then reviews come in and it's like 4 stars out of 5 and I'm giving you 4 stars because of the back closure, you're like, oh, I knew it. And so now I'm always pushing our team to be like, no, make this better. Like this is going to be the thing that people are going to say, if only this. And so I think internally you have to hold yourself to a pretty high bar and high standard. And with that, you have to be patient. And you're right. Like we haven't brought on a lot of external funding. And I actually think that that has been a huge asset for us because I haven't had to report to other people on a plan or a forecast. Do you know what I mean? Sure. Where we're relying on like a big product launch to kind of like make our quarter or make our year. And what that has meant is that we can push things back because we don't feel like we're ready, not really have to explain it to anyone except for ourselves. You see it all the time with companies. Like they start with, you know, a really magic, beautiful product, and then they start pushing and pushing into different things and the quality gets diluted or the strength isn't there yet. And so I'm grateful that like we've had the opportunity to be patient in certain areas.
When you're going into a new category, are you budgeting like this is how much we're going to spend on the product development process? This is how long we want to spend researching and developing this product at the outset? And then if you don't hit that, you keep going? Or like, how do you think about it? Or is it more organic than that?
I think I say, ideally, we'd love to launch at this date, but we have to make sure the product's right first. And so if that moves, then it moves, and sort of giving people the space around that. I also think a different way that we approach product than a lot of the big brands is, and certainly like my product and design team was like, wait, what? I go in saying, don't worry about how much it's going to cost. Just make the best thing you possibly can.
You mean the product?
Can. The product, yeah. And we'll figure out the pricing on the other end. And so what that does is it allows a lot of creative freedom that I think doesn't necessarily exist elsewhere. And I think, you know, being direct to consumer, you don't have the middlemen, so you don't have as much margin pressure, which gives you a lot more flexibility. And so that, I find, just opens up the creative space in a really big way.
Let's talk about that for a sec, because obviously, if people are familiar with your story, you were in wholesale at first. That was the way that you approached building the business. And at some point, what year was it that you decided to make the switch to 100% direct-to-consumer?
It was 2016. So about, had been building the company for about 3 years when we shifted. Yeah. So I started in wholesale. Basically, I had like a PR stunt idea to pitch a department store to buy through our crowdfunding campaign at the time, thinking that we would get a lot of press around it. And we did. We got like a ton of media coverage and it was great. But there were only 3 people on my team at the time. And it turns out that like servicing a very large scale department store is kind of hard. It takes a lot of time and energy. And so in the beginning, our focus was really on building out our wholesale channels. And it's how I spent the first 3 years of NYX. I went to trade shows. I went and did trunk shows. I, you know, did product knowledge sessions. I was on the road kind of nonstop. And we built up the distribution to be in sort of 700 or 800 retail doors. And then ultimately realized that a lot of our partners weren't willing to carry our size range. Specifically when we expanded into bras, this became like a really big point of contention. And the more that we were leaning into sort of our inclusive messaging, the bigger the disconnect became between how someone would interact with us on, say, our site and our social media channels, and then the experience that they would have when they would drive to one of our retail partners and be turned away because the, you know, fitness outlet only carried smalls and mediums. We kind of came to a crossroads where I felt like we had to make this step, but it was very, very, very scary at the time because it was 75% of our revenue that we just pulled out of.
That's very familiar to me because the company that I started with my current co-founder, we had a previous company and we were selling to wholesalers. It was in an art supply product category. And so, but we were selling to Michaels and Joann's and Urban Outfitters. And we also had a similar type of setup we were in about. We had also done a Kickstarter campaign and, you know, had grown to like something like 1,500 retail stores and basically decided this is not fun. And we want to be able to have like, you know, a more direct relationship with our customers. We ended up shutting down that company and starting Lumi in what it is today. But it was a completely, very similar type of experience. And in the beginning, what's powerful about the wholesale relationship is like if you're a small team, you get a certain amount of leverage because, you know, if you can sell to one buyer and they can buy a lot of inventory at once from you, that's awesome instead of having to sell, you know, individual units to one person at a time. But that the trade-off is then you have no control over what's going on. It's just like, and the wholesalers or the retailers that buy your product we just struggled so much with the payment terms and stuff that they pushed us through. It was really difficult.
Yes.
Just the cash flow is so, so hard.
Yeah. So, so hard.
So, but for you, you know, we decided like, hey, let's start something new and give up on that idea. You actually kept going with it and had to make that transition. That must have been really difficult. How did you convince your team that it was the right idea? How did you figure out how to do that? And what it must have been, was it like cold turkey or did it happen gradually? How did it unfold?
It happened gradually. It started with like switching up our supply chain and all the like very unsexy stuff that no customers see on the outset. But that probably took about 9 months to kind of switch vendors and switch 3PLs and think about packaging. Actually, to be honest with you, our packaging, we only changed like a year ago. So that it's been a multi-year process for us.
But was there a moment where you said, let's do this? And then it, you know, there was like it took a while to actually happen. Or did it feel like you were still experimenting with the idea of going DTC and trying to figure out if it would work or not? And then eventually hit that point where you're like, okay, we're committing 100%.
Yeah. So we made the commitment to do it and started making those changes. You know, it was like one of those funny things where a month before something, I like just invested like so much money in retail fixtures and new displays and all this stuff. And I had one amazing employee and teammate who was my first employee who was handling our sales piece. And so to be honest with you, like I think I let them go in tandem a bit longer than I had wanted to, just because she'd built out a lot of our distribution. And I think it was harder, honestly, on her than it was on me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, especially
if you're really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to make people feel bad who's been working so hard on something, for sure.
Exactly. So what we did at first was we went from being like always available, and basically anytime a retailer wanted any piece of our product, we would like drop everything and they could have it, to moving to quarterly shipments, which we did for a year, limiting what people could buy and not doing fill-ins or anything like that. And really giving ourselves the chance, like we always sold online, but we never gave ourselves first access to inventory, which I'm sure that you can relate to given where you came from, where, you know, maybe we had 1,000 units in stock, but all of them had been committed for orders that were shipping like 2 months later, you know, like it was just so silly. You know, I was like, let's just give ourselves a chance and see what happens when we give ourselves first access. And it was really fast. Like within 30 days, our digital was outperforming the retail channels. And so it became clear really quickly. I just also liked it so much more. I think as a founder, like, so much of a business's success has to do with how much with your energy, you know, and how much like gas you have in the tank. And I found that the shift to sell online and the ability to engage directly with our customers, to become more of a storyteller, you know, it really energized me. And even like all of the data and the analytics side, it made so much more sense to me, because both of my degrees are in business. Like the meetings with buyers and them being like, you should make orange, you know, orange is a color this season. And like just these like arbitrary kind of pieces of feedback that you would get, versus being able to actually like look at what people are buying and plan and respond and react and adapt. That was a big part of it too. Like I literally felt like I started a second company. And to your point around like, how did the team take it? I didn't really have a team really before. So there were like maybe three of us. And so I got to start over 3 years into Nyx, and I got to build out a whole new team and had sort of a second chance of like redefining who I wanted to be as a leader. I'd obviously, like, because of the way that we approach our brand, had grown a lot personally over the course of Nyx. It was kind of refreshing and empowering to almost get to start fresh, but with all of this experience that I had been accumulating over the years.
I mean, obviously with Kickstarter you had, but had you started building up an audience on Instagram or Facebook or these other places you made the switch?
Yeah.
So it was for them, it was like, hey, now you can buy it on our website.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And that, because before that you were saying like, here's all the stores where you can buy the product.
Yes. And we were like, you can buy this online, but actually we never have any stock, so you can't really buy it online. Like that was kind of the biggest piece of feedback that we would get in the early days. Like, you guys never have product. But we did. It was just sitting in a warehouse being reserved by our ERP system because we committed it to some store to ship to, like, you know, at some point in the future. So yeah, I think our customers were like, finally, like, I can buy my size and you're selling what I want. So that was it. That was good, positive reinforcement.
And I guess nowadays, sort of more traditional brands do this too. Like, I know Oreo or something has their own Instagram account, but they don't sell. Maybe Oreo sells direct now, but it's just a thing where once you are selling direct to consumer, there's so much of a tighter connection right away, even in the messaging, because you can do so much more of just saying like, hey, now this thing is available. Click here. Go to this place.
Whereas
if there's so much time that has to elapse between like this product has been developed and gone through all the cycles of distribution and everything before you can go buy it. And then your message to the people is like, go to whatever store to go do the thing. There's so many points of friction there that it's just like, that's why no one like before direct to consumer had an affiliation with like a brand that they like love so much that they would actually want to follow it on Instagram.
Yeah. And I mean, like, to go full circle to what you were talking about before, like moving away from a buying schedule when it came to product development, like it just takes a lot of the time pressure off of it, right?
Sure.
Because you're not like, oh, I need this to be done by June, because our trade shows start June 15th. And if I want to sell this in for like the following year, then it has to be done now. You know, like everything's a lot more instantaneous. And I do agree, like you can actually build a real connection and relationship with a brand.
And so that's spread out into other things as well for you, like events. And we'll talk about that, your podcast, which I'm really excited to talk about. But what about the events? Like, tell me a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah. So we've been experimenting with events for a while now, and we love to do things that encourage women to step outside of their comfort zone. So the first series of events that we did was called Spin in Your Skin, where we would rent out a spin studio, give everyone Knix underwear, and then do a spin class in your underwear with black lights, and just like a really kind of badass, uplifting experience. And so that was kind of our first dabble into things. We did our first pop-up, I guess, like now a year and a half ago. We actually converted a 6,000 square foot nightclub into a store / gym.
Wow.
Yeah. Which was like very different, and would host free classes throughout the day and like huge events with like, you know, a couple hundred people. And now we're just starting to do more pop-ups, smaller scale, but still very much driven around the concept of community and like bringing people together to either learn something new or maybe talk about things that they don't normally talk about, just expand their horizons.
And when you think about all of the different channels, events, Instagram, podcasts, et cetera, how do you differentiate between your kind of your Knix teen audience and the Knix, you know, adult or whatever you want to call
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so it's totally separate. So Knix teen has all of its own social accounts and does it. We do our own events. So, I mean, we basically run two separate companies.
Wow.
Yeah. But the common thread is the product. We can leverage a lot of the same technology, but they're very, very, very different brands. And I actually love our teen brand because you can take a lot more risks with that market. It's just a generation, I think, that's a lot more open than certainly I was before. And so we've learned a lot, and I think have pushed. I think that by creating Knix Teen, it's pushed our Knix brand to evolve as well.
As far as the team behind it, is it the same people, or do you literally have completely different people working on the marketing for one versus the other?
Yeah, so we take like a shared services approach, but it has its own brand team. And then we share like operations, finance, product development, but it's separate people.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems like a big...
Undertaking,
yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, it's just funny because we keep talking about this recurring theme of like, hey, how do you take on these big new initiatives without necessarily, you know, like having all the budget behind it to make that decision? Like, what gives you the confidence to say like, this is going to work, we should invest in this?
I think just listening and talking to people, like Knix Teen, what we just kept hearing over and over and over again was, oh, I wish that this existed when I was a teen, or can you make smaller sizes? This would be amazing for my teen daughter. And we just kept hearing that on auto repeat. And then a lot of the decisions that I make are driven by, this is like not the best answer, but are driven by my gut and
no,
my instincts.
Great.
And a lot of them are driven by passion as well. When we started looking into Knix Teen and I was doing the research around periods, it's one of the top five drivers of stress amongst young girls is, when am I going to get my period? All my friends have their periods. What's going to happen to me with my period? And it's up there with bullying and relationships, anxiety, like mental health. Like it's a pretty big driver of stress. And I certainly can't help with some of those other things. But I felt like we had a really great product that could make a big difference, specifically by turning periods into not a big deal. You know, you've taken like a very human approach, I think, to building Knix. And what happens is that I kind of like uncover some hairy problem or some insight and feel like we have to be the ones to do it. And so that certainly was the case with Knix Teen. I think the other standout or obvious one, which comes back to the podcast, is a lot of the work that we've been doing around fertility. And yeah, like it may be, they're big undertakings. And I think it's a challenge of working at our company, to be honest, is like I always want to push forward. Like, I'm always like, okay, like, let's keep going. What's the next thing? Like, we're constantly, constantly moving. And I think we're able to pull things off very quickly in ways that a lot of other companies can't. Or if people saw it, it would give them like severe anxiety.
Is it something, do you find that it ever hurts other parts where you're like, you know, it comes at the expense of something else?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that that's something that I've been learning as a leader more recently, like kind of weigh the resources that it's going to take. And then, you know, is this the best use of resources? Should we be spending more time on other things? And also being willing to walk away from things if they're not working is kind of another big thing. We're doing pop-ups at the moment, and some of them, you know, we have one that's going really well and we have one that's not going so well. And so I don't know if I should say this, but like, we're going to shut it down early because it's like, it's just not worth it. You know, it's not worth fighting so hard when clearly like we're not in the right location and the foot traffic's not there. And like, it's just takes too much energy and we're not going to move the needle. And so I'd rather like wave a little white flag and refocus the team's effort on something else that's going to have a bigger impact.
I had a question about Nick's teen, which is I didn't have a credit card when I was a teenager. Yes. How does that
work?
Great question. Do you find that's a challenge?
It is a challenge. And we've built in sort of like an app where you can like text your mom or your parent or your guardian.
Oh, wow.
And tell them that you want them to buy it for you.
Do you think that Apple Pay or like Shopify is going to be able to address that type of challenge? Because it seems like there are some of those things that are coming out that might enable teenagers to buy things on the internet. I don't know. It's an interesting challenge.
It is an interesting challenge. I mean, we don't sell through Amazon at the moment, but certainly through a lot of the research we've done, we know as well that oftentimes teens have like access to an Amazon Prime account or something like that. So I think like this automated checkout thing is going to help for sure. Nick's Teen's an interesting one because we have to take a dual pronged marketing approach. So we have to make the brand engaging and cool enough that teens are interested in it and preteens are interested in it. And so if you go on our Instagram or you visit our blog, like all of that content is really geared towards teens. I think we do a great job of getting traffic and like getting teens interested. And then on the paid side, it's catered all towards the parent because they're the ones that ultimately have the money.
When you think about how commerce will evolve over the next like 10 years, like, is there anything that you've learned about teenagers today that you think is going to change something about, you know, once they all become adults and have their own credit cards and stuff like that? Do you think that it's going to change fundamentally anything about how people shop online?
Well, I mean, it's like macro trends that are so obvious, but like mobile first and only, like basically none of our traffic comes from a desktop or a laptop for our teen line. It's all mobile first. And then teens don't use email addresses. Like the concept of email is like so outdated. So a lot of our communication goes through text with them. Things like that, you know, where I don't know about other companies, but certainly for us at Nick's, like email's a huge part of what we do, right? Like we send a ton of emails. And it's a big revenue driver. And so just the thought that like that's going to change, I think is kind of interesting how you communicate in more bite-sized manageable pieces. And then I think like one of the more exciting things is that it is true that like as a whole, it's a more socially conscious group. And so I think that creates like a really interesting opportunity for brands and for disruptor brands that it is about more now.
I want to talk about the podcast before we wrap up here. Faces of Fertility, you launched this recently. You're a podcaster now. How did you decide to go into that?
Yeah. So we launched our podcast in April of this year. So we can cut that out if you want. I know sometimes it's not good to timestamp on podcasts. I've learned that from being a podcast host. Our producer's always like, don't mention the dates. don't talk about the weather.
We don't care. It's fine.
You guys don't care. Okay. Okay, great.
You launched the podcast a few months ago at some point in time.
A few months ago at some point in time. Thank you. Yeah. And it was an extension of our Faces of Fertility campaign that basically was inspired. I'm talking about dates, but on Mother's Day of last year, I was pregnant and I had a miscarriage. And it was a moment where I think at NYCS we've always done a great job of being like empathetic to other people's feelings. And so we put a post on our social feeds that was basically just acknowledging that like it can be a really hard day for people. It can be a beautiful day, but it also can be a hard day. You know, relationships are tricky and people have a lot of different relationships with their mom. And so basically this is a long-winded answer around your podcast, but everyone told me to avoid social media that day and not to go online. And I lasted a few hours, but I caved. And amidst all of the photos that I was seeing, I found myself like really stuck in the comments of the post that we put up. And just hearing from so many women that like we were the only group that made them feel heard and that got them that day. And like the strangest thing happened to me over the course of 24 hours. I feel like I woke up and I completely changed the way that I looked at myself. I changed the way that I looked at all of the people and women around me. And I just became fascinated with this concept of fertility and specifically how it's tied to the female identity. Because in that moment when I had my miscarriage, like I never in my life had felt like more of a failure as a woman than in that moment. So we did some like social listening. I had some people incognito on my team go online and look and see if this was a conversation that people were ready to have. And about 4 or 5 months later, we launched our campaign, which to begin with featured a few dozen interviews and videos and blog posts that covered the whole facet of fertility, which I think is like such an interesting topic because there's so many different components to it. And I was really blown away with when we launched that campaign, how many stories came forward. I think we had like over 1,600 uses of our hashtag, which doesn't seem like that much. But when you consider the fact that that was 1,600 people sharing something so personal, yeah, you know.
It's a big deal.
It was kind of a big deal, yeah. And so what we found was that this was an amazing conversation for to be had and one that really loaned itself to podcasting because it is really intimate and the stories are deeply personal and we endeavored to make a podcast.
Is this something you see being like a long-term thing or is it kind of have a beginning and an end? How do you think about that?
You know, we're trying to figure that out right now. And I don't know if you found this, but getting like the initial guests on our podcast was kind of challenging, especially because with such a personal topic, like people just, they don't really know how you're going to approach it, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a risk. And so since we've launched it, we've had so many people come forward that want to be guests. We just had our first pregnancy to come out of our podcast. So we did an article or an episode around a woman who decided she wanted to be a single mom. And so she self-inseminated with a Diva cup, probably going over your head right now, but it's like a menstrual cup. And she was having a baby. And so we interviewed her on our show and then had a listener who had been trying to get pregnant for 2 years, had gone through 3 rounds of IVF, 2 IUIs, 3 egg retrievals, like basically spent, you know, well over $100,000 on this to no success. Heard our podcast and was like, well, I might as well try this. Bought a Diva cup for $30 and is pregnant with twins. And so when we set out to make the podcast, I always said like, this isn't going to be a huge, it's about quality over quantity. Like it's not going to be the kind of thing that's going to amass like millions of listeners. It's a bit, you know, I don't think it's a niche topic, but it's like a bit out there. And I see that it's actually having like a big impact on the people who are listening. So I'd love to keep doing it, in short. Whether we continue to do it through the brand or whether it becomes something that I just do more like in my spare time, because I have so much of that. I think it's important. So yeah, And I've gotten some awesome tips by doing this with you guys, like the microphone you sent me. just learning how to make it better.
I think it's a fascinating trend because I've seen a few other brands that have started to do podcasts. And I think it makes sense. It's a very personal medium because people are listening to it and it's, you know, usually long form. And, you know, it's probably going to be 20 minutes to like 2 hours long, depending on mm-hmm. what kind of show you're doing. And so you can build it's much more nuanced than almost anything else that you can do. But I think it doesn't have the same kind of like organic growth that something like, you know, Instagram can have, where you can also even just, you know, advertise against it and try to get people to, you know, come to your page. It's a bit more of an upfront investment to go ahead and actually like listen to a podcast. So it doesn't have the same virality. But if you have the patience for it and you're like, you want to, you're going to naturally want to do it. Like I do for this show. For me, it's just kind of selfishly fascinating. And I feel like lucky that I can do it for Lumi as well. That's the motivation that keeps you going.
Yeah, for sure.
And then hopefully like the audience comes with it over time. But I mm-hmm. think that a lot of people who are trying this see it as like, hey, what's Instagram is, you know, the costs are getting so high. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, what's next? And podcasts. It's not really that way in my mind. I think it's a very different kind of investment, and you have to be like willing to do it for the long term if you want to get something out of it.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, it's not like an overnight scalable thing. But if to your point, like it's something that fuels you and that can add a lot of value to the people who listen, then it can be really interesting.
I think it can be kind of demoralizing as when you look at, you know, the big podcasts out there and you go to their, you know, NPR, for example, is just like incredible at promoting new podcasts, and they can quickly, they're a brand that is all about audio. So if they launch something new, they can get probably millions of listeners to, you know, move in that direction pretty fast.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there with like, you know, 3 reviews on your iTunes and you're like, dang, how can we get more listeners?
Yeah.
That part is hard.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that's the big question around it is like, do we want it to just live as this like organic self-discovery thing, or do we try and make a go at it? You know what I mean? And like market it on other podcasts and like go that route. What have you guys done? Can I ask? Like, is it all?
Yeah, for us, it's been all like organic growth. But I think it would be interesting to try advertising the podcast and see what happens. We also don't do advertisements on the show, so we don't. We've had sponsors reach out to us, but we've never done it. For us, it's a little bit different because our audience is more B2B, so mm-hmm. it's okay if it's not millions of people listening to it.
Yeah. Like,
we're not trying to target millions of people. Same thing with our YouTube show. Our YouTube show, that one you can publicly see the views. Like probably we have some of them that are outliers that are probably in the tens of thousands of views. Like I think our biggest one is probably like 50,000 views on a video about cardboard boxes. But most of them are in the thousands, like low thousands. But on the other hand, our budget for the episodes is something like $100. And we've had customers come out of that who spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. So the delta,
is
so different for us than it would be for a consumer brand. And so that makes it maybe a little easier for us to make that investment.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
But if you're trying to get a lot of people to, you know, listen to it or watch your show or do that thing, most likely advertising it could really work, I think.
Yeah, it's just something that we've been asked about, or at least when I've talked to other people, oftentimes it's like part of it, but we haven't endeavored down that path yet.
The thing we've really struggled with is we have a lot of followers on our Instagram, and I think a lot of the folks who follow us on Instagram just like it for the inspiration of, hey, these are cool looking packaging things. And mm-hmm. whenever we've tried to talk about the podcast on Instagram, it's not really worked very well. We get more success talking about it in Instagram stories than the regular photos. But maybe that would be different for you because your Instagram is already about people and your community. So basically, it's like weird when you're following Lumi for like, oh, cool photos of graphic design and boxes, and then suddenly some one's face pops up. They're like, that's not what I'm following you for.
Yeah, I think that we've been experimenting with like what posts around the podcast do the best.
Yeah.
And probably like as a mistake, like we made a bunch that just like have the logo and then you can see like the audio waves and it plays a trailer. And then, you know, more recently we started kind of sharing like a Nick style photo of the people that we have, the person that we have on the show, and just doing it more our way.
Yeah.
Instead of sort of what we'd seen elsewhere. And that works a lot better.
That's awesome. So if people want to find out more about Nick's, Nick's.com, great domain. And you're on Twitter, Joe Griffiths. We'll put some link to all of that stuff. Is there anything you want to point people to?
Yeah, Nick's.com or our Instagram, which is at Nick'swear, or probably an at Nick'steen are the best places to go.
Cool. We'll put some more links in the show notes, and I would really encourage people to check out your podcast too. It's really fascinating. I think everyone could use a little bit of empathy for those women who are going through that and just sort of understanding the challenges that different people face. I listened to it. I thought it was really fascinating.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And men, we have some men on the show too. We will do more of that next season as well. But yeah, it's just gives you a new perspective, like you said, and a new lens.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.